Today is Wednesday, December 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. U.S. President Biden's chief medical advisor says the new coronavirus variant may have come to Europe earlier than thought and urges everyone eligible to get the booster.
We are hoping, and I think with good reason, to feel good that there will be some degree of protection.
Former U.S. Vice President Mike Pence hopes the U.S. Supreme Court will gut the landmark Roe v. Wade decision legalizing abortion.
We may well be on the verge of an era when the Supreme Court sends Roe v. Wade to the ash heap of history where it belongs.
And Vladimir Putin says Russia wants Western guarantees before any NATO expansion. We'll have these stories and more next. The European Commission says the European Union needs daily reviews of its travel restrictions and the rapid deployment of vaccine boosters to protect citizens from the new coronavirus variant Omicron. Europe is going through a surge of COVID-19 cases, and rising number of infections are linked to the new variant. Dr. Anthony Fauci, U.S. President Joe Biden's chief medical advisor, says the Omicron variant may have reached Europe much earlier than thought. At a White House briefing on Tuesday, Dr. Fauci urged all eligible people to get the booster shot.
We know that when you boost somebody, you elevate your level of protection very high. And we are hoping, and I think with good reason, to feel good that there will be some degree of protection.
The director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, says health officials are searching for the new variant among travelers who come to the U.S., but so far have found no cases.
Right now, there is no evidence of Omicron in the United States. The Delta variant remains the predominant circulating strain, representing 99.9% of all sequences sampled.
With the new variant keeping health experts on high alert, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control says everyone ages 18 and up should get the booster shot. AP correspondent Mike Gracia reports.
In a preemptive move to head off the new COVID-19 variant Omicron, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention late Monday recommended booster shots for all adults. CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky also encouraged Americans feeling unwell to seek out a COVID-19 test. Pharmaceutical companies are adjusting their existing COVID-19 vaccines to better attack the Omicron variant, but an Omicron-specific vaccine probably won't be in production for another 2 or 3 months. Still, Dr. William Moss of Johns Hopkins University says,
we just know in general that higher levels of neutralizing antibodies are protective against across different variants.
So far, there have not been any cases of Omicron detected in the United States. In an effort to thwart the arrival of Omicron in the U.S., restrictions on travel from South Africa and 7 other countries in Southern Africa took effect Monday. I'm Mike Gracia.
Russian President Vladimir Putin said Wednesday that Moscow would seek Western guarantees that would preclude any further NATO expansion and deployment of weapons near Russia's borders. The statement comes as NATO foreign ministers met in Latvia largely to discuss Russia's military buildup along Ukraine's border and worries that it may invade Ukraine. At a news conference this week, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the U.S. has seen Russian aggression before.
We have seen Russia's playbook many times over. And part of that playbook is to attempt to create and manufacture a so-called provocation as justification for something that Russia is planning to do all along.
Blinken will meet his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, in Stockholm on Thursday amid the renewed military tensions. Demonstrators are expected to converge at the U.S. Supreme Court in Washington Wednesday as the justices take up a Mississippi case that could overturn the landmark ruling that legalized abortion several decades ago. Many conservatives hope the high court will reverse what's called the Roe versus Wade decision. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
The Supreme Court now has a conservative majority and will hear arguments surrounding the Mississippi law that bans abortions after 15 weeks. That's months before what's been known as the point of viability, when a fetus could survive outside the womb. The court is also weighing challenges to a Texas law that bans abortions after 6 weeks. Former Vice President Mike Pence is among those calling for an end to abortions.
We may well be on the verge of an era when the Supreme Court sends Roe versus Wade to the ash heap of history where it belongs.
The court's decision's expected by late June. It could uphold current precedent, allow the Mississippi law to stand, which eliminates the current viability standard, or the justices could fully overturn Roe versus Wade. I'm Jackie Quinn.
Former President Donald Trump's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, has agreed to cooperate with the U.S. House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection. The panel is also getting ready to vote on pursuing contempt charges against Jeffrey Clark, another prominent former Trump administration official. I asked VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson to shed some light on Clark's background.
Investors may remember that he is a former Justice Department lawyer who was part of the Trump administration. He was very involved in the final days of the Trump presidency when the former president was looking into unsubstantiated claims of election fraud and reportedly pushing the Justice Department to pursue those fraud claims to try and overturn the results of the 2020 election. At a certain point, former President Trump considered elevating Clark to become the attorney general. So obviously, this is an individual who is a key part of the investigation into the events of January 6th and someone that Democratic House lawmakers very much want to talk to. He initially gave an interview of about 90 minutes earlier this year to investigators before walking out along with his lawyer, saying that his conversations with President Trump were protected under this concept of executive privilege, which shields some presidential conversations from being revealed to the public on the grounds that they would endanger security.
Jeffrey Clark is considered one of the primary officials that they'd like to talk to, right?
That's absolutely right. Because he was so deeply involved in those discussions with President Trump in the final days of the Trump presidency, and of course, leading up to the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, which was primarily motivated by the attempt to overturn the results of the 2020 election. So basically, investigators are going through and looking at all the different members of the Trump campaign, the Trump administration, and trying to put together the pieces of how much of this insurrection was planned ahead of time, how was it funded, how was it motivated, and what were the ultimate goals. And of course, someone who at the Justice Department who is looking to overturn the election and investigate those fraud claims would be a very, very important part of that puzzle.
There is another prominent type of official from the Trump administration who has indicated that he's willing to cooperate. Can you tell us a little bit more about that person?
That's right. So that's former Trump chief of staff Mark Meadows, who was the final chief of staff in the Trump White House, and of course was the chief of staff during the events of January 6th and during the investigation into election fraud. He has said that he will cooperate with the panel on a limited basis, but I would not be at all surprised to have this issue of executive privilege come up again, especially considering he's the White House chief of staff and would have had numerous conversations with former President Trump that could fall under that umbrella of executive privilege. So I would expect this issue, this conflict between former Trump administration officials and Democratic House investigators to come up again when it's his turn to speak to them.
That is VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. She was speaking with me earlier Wednesday about the U.S. House panel's investigation of the January 6th U.S. Capitol insurrection. You're listening to VOA News. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Carol Van Dam. With Syrian rebels facing defeat, Turkey, one of the rebels' main backers, is now facing growing calls to restore diplomatic relations with Damascus. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
With Syrian rebels facing defeat, Arab countries are starting to reach out to Syria, ending years of diplomatic isolation. There is now growing pressure for Turkey, among the principal backers of the rebels, to do the same. Ünal Çevikköz is an opposition lawmaker with the CHP party.
All the Arab countries are now realizing that Assad is going to stay in power, and that's the reason why they are now considering opening their embassies, for example, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, etc. All the Arab countries are now trying to embrace the Syrian administration again, but Turkey is not doing that. So I think the key to the solution is to establish a dialogue between Ankara and Damascus.
Returning the 4 million Syrian refugees who fled the civil war is a top campaign promise by Turkey's main opposition, Republican People's Party, CHP. The party argues that restoring diplomatic ties with Syria cut at the start of the conflict is key to fulfilling that pledge, which has widespread support in Turkey. But President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is ruling out any change. It's a stance backed by some experts who say bestowing legitimacy on the Damascus regime must be part of a broader, inclusive political solution. Former Turkish ambassador to Damascus, Ömer Onhorn.
Problem is giving legitimacy and political recognition. I think the regime has to prove itself, I think. I mean, the regime has to prove that they are sincere about seeking a real political solution. But up to now, this is not the case.
Turkey's military presence in Syria could also complicate any restoration of relations with Syria. Damascus is calling for a Turkish pullout. The Turkish forces are in Syria to counter the predominantly Kurdish Syrian Democratic Forces, which Ankara accuses of having links to Kurdish separatists fighting in Turkey, a charge the SDF denies. Given the complex situation in Syria, some analysts warn restoring Syrian diplomatic ties is not a solution on its own. Aydın Selgen is with the online broadcaster Mediascope.
Turkey should be more active opening those diplomatic channels with various Arab countries, Israel and Syria, but also Turkey should talk to different actors like the SDF in the east of Euphrates, and also to Brussels.
Damascus and Ankara share common ground in their opposition to Syrian Kurdish aspirations for autonomy, and that could yet prove to be a powerful impetus for a rapprochement between the neighbors. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
In search of a better life, many migrants cross from Africa to Europe through what has been dubbed the deadliest border in the world, the Mediterranean Sea. The International Organization for Migration says despite the risks, the number of people crossing has doubled in the first half of this year to an estimated 77,000. For VOA, Raoud Elmendorp reports from on board the Ocean Viking, a rescue vessel in the Mediterranean Sea.
We're on the Mediterranean Sea in international waters in front of the Libyan coast. We're in an inflatable rescue ship dispatched by the group SOS Mediterranee. And before us is a small wooden boat dancing on the waves. And we hear the calling of more than 100 migrants on board. And one can only imagine what's it like to be floating here without an engine and only the stars as a witness of your presence. The rescuers give life jackets in case the overloaded boat breaks. Then the migrants start to cross, one by one, into the rescue boat. Nobody is left behind. For them, this small step is a giant leap to a better life. Conditions at sea can be devastating, says a rescuer, who identified himself only as Tanguy.
We had operation with people suffering from bullet wounds. Sometimes you have some people who already died in the target because of suffocation, because of whatever. So it's like it's very different all the time.
Requiring green light to disembark 19 mail.
Propelled by the heavy dual engines, the rescue boat returns to the mothership, Ocean Viking, which is chartered by SOS Mediterranee. Negotiating the rocky waves, the migrants climb the ladder onto the ship. On board the Ocean Viking, survivors receive clothes and a place to sleep. Some migrants sit on the wooden deck, while others seek the refuge of a container made suitable as living space. There is 40-year-old curtain maker Salim from Syria, who fled his country to keep his son out of the army. They are playing dominoes. His son is called Mahmoud.
I come to here with my father from Syria because I should go to the war after 18 years. So I am come with my father to the Libya and from Libya to the Italy and the sea.
Father and son and the other more than 300 rescued migrants passed their time during the rescue mission while enduring encounters with the Libyan Coast Guard that is known for pushing migrants back to Libya. Rescue coordinator Anita says that the Coast Guard does not have jurisdiction.
I think that they are coming and trying to intimidate us to stop heading towards their waters, which we would still in any case never go inside Libyan's water.
The International Organization for Migration attributes the rise of the number of new arrivals to a deteriorating human rights situation in Libya. The migrants from across Africa seek safety in Europe, like 32-year-old Annabelle Phillips, who came with her baby Clement.
Security of life that I cannot have in Nigeria.
That's
for my child, because in Nigeria there's not like security, no security in Nigeria.
The Ocean Viking operates in a zone the size of Denmark, making the chances of spotting a migrant ship minimal. Critics argue that rescue operations invite migrants to take deadly risks. Claire Jucha, communications officer on board the Ocean Viking, disagrees.
We can see that clearly during COVID times as well. Last April, for instance, in April 2020, when the pandemic outbreak actually paralyzed the world, people kept fleeing, but we just heard more reports of shipwrecks.
When they have picked up enough survivors, the Ocean Viking starts for Italy. The migrants play and sleep through the days, until excitement ensues when a critically ill person is evacuated by the Italian Coast Guard to the port of Lampedusa. Then, after 4 days, the moment arrives.
We are going to Italy!
The assignment of a port of safety ends a journey that for some survivors took years. The next step is to see whether they have COVID-19. Then they will be transferred to land, into centers where it will be determined whether they can be asylum seekers, refugees or not. The Ocean Viking has arrived in the port of Augusta in Sicily. The gangway has been lowered. For the migrants, a stressful moment arises. Will they really step on land and be safe after a perilous journey? Carefully they step forward, being encouraged by SOS rescuers. A tap on the shoulder, a motivated last word whispered in the ear, and they enter a tent where the authorities register the arrivals. Then another journey starts. Being granted asylum can take years, and the unlucky ones may be sent back home or disappear into Italy's tough informal economy. Ruth Elmendorf for VOA News, Augusta, Italy.
In Germany, the country's intensive care association is calling for national COVID-19 restrictions to be imposed immediately. It's warning that the number of COVID-19 patients requiring intensive care will hit a new high before Christmas. Chancellor-designate Olaf Scholz says he will support a proposal to mandate coronavirus vaccinations for everyone next year. Commanders of the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force and the U.S. Navy have said that the two nations will enhance ties to ensure a free and open Indo-Pacific Ocean. For 10 days, naval exercises have been underway in waters around Japan, with Japanese, U.S., Australian, Canadian, and German ships taking part. It's the first time the German Navy has been involved in the drill, which happens every 2 years. In the U.S. Midwestern state of Michigan, a 15-year-old boy opened fire at his high school, killing 3 students. One 16-year-old boy died in a deputy's patrol car on his way to a hospital Tuesday. 8 other people were wounded. Oakland County Sheriff Michael Bouchard says investigators are still trying to figure out a motive for the shooting. He says the shooting suspect is refusing to speak to investigators. Bouchard says the boy's father had bought the gun used in the shooting last week. In Afghanistan, high school girls are staying at home almost everywhere, forbidden to attend school by the Taliban rules. Everywhere, that is, except the western province of Herat, where girls have been back in classrooms. It's the byproduct of a unique combined effort by teachers and parents to persuade local Taliban administrators to allow them to reopen high schools. Taliban officials did not formally approve of the reopening, but did not prevent it either. Teachers and parents opened classes on their own in October. In Kenya, refugees and their supporters have welcomed a new law that gives the country's 500,000 refugees better access to education and work. But the law comes as Kenya plans to close two of the region's largest refugee camps, which are home to more than 400,000 people who fled conflict in Somalia and South Sudan. Brenda Mulinya reports from Nairobi.
Willie Rari, a refugee from Burundi, has been in Kenya for the last 7 years without a regular source of income. He holds a diploma in mechanical training from Burundi and an additional one from Kenya. Yet, he has been unable to find steady unemployment in the country's capital, Nairobi. Refugees like him have to make do with what they get, he says. He says, we take up whichever jobs we get, even construction site jobs, because we don't have the required paper to get jobs we are qualified for. He says, we can get the Certificate of Good Conduct papers, the National Hospital Insurance, the Kenya Revenue Authority PINs, the National Social Security Fund papers, and to get any job here, you must have that. Rari's hopes of getting a decent job now lie with the speedy implementation of the new refugees bill that President Uhuru Kenyatta recently signed into law. The law paves the way for refugees to integrate into the Kenyan economy and social life. Victor Odero of the International Rescue Committee says the new law is a bright spot in the quest for empowering refugees.
There was no obligation, certainly in law, the state to facilitate the issuance of legal documentation through which then refugees would be able to get economic and social development, basically become self-reliant.
That ability for refugees to participate in Kenyan society has also been welcomed by the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. The agency spokesperson in Kenya, Eugene Bayan, says this will make the refugees feel valued and dignified in their new homes.
Integration for a refugee is critical. One, because refugees don't want to be the other, and they want to continue their life while seeking asylum in host country until they can return to their country safely.
The new law comes ahead of the planned closure next year of Kenya's two largest refugee camps, which together house more than 400,000 people, most from Somalia or South Sudan. Odero says the law will help make the process of clearing the camps easier.
Refugee camps are simply unsustainable. I think this is something that people agree on across the board. So the question has been, where or can we have a legal framework that gives sufficient anchorage to durable solutions? And what we can see from this legislation is that it moves things forward. It is actually progressive.
The close to 500,000 refugees in Kenya, just like Rari, want the law to take effect soon so that they can get the chance to earn a decent living outside of the camps. Brenda Mulinya for VOA News, Nairobi.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A group of researchers from Portugal, Denmark, and Germany has identified a new dinosaur species, which they also call the first dinosaur to live in Greenland. Izisaanek, which in the language of the native Greenland Inuit means cold bone. The researchers say the dinosaur had two legs, a long neck, was medium-sized, and an herbivore. Izzy is said to have lived in what is now Greenland about 214 million years ago during the late Triassic period. According to a press release from the Martin Luther University Halle of Wittenberg, during its time on Earth, Greenland was part of the supercontinent Pangaea, which was then breaking apart. The researchers examined two skulls that were first discovered by Harvard University scientists during a 1994 excavation in East Greenland. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Carol Bendem in Washington.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC.